This is All In. I'm Miriam. So what has life been like for the past year in Indiana? Going from crowded venues to empty streets as folks grappled with news trickling in that things weren't going to be the same for a long time. What about school life? Students who used to have so many social events now dealing with virtual or hybrid learning. With us now to look into how families and students have been dealing with all of this for the past year is Jeannie Lindsay. She's the education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Jeannie. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start with, you're working on this feature piece right now about life for families a year later. Tell us a little bit about this piece and what you're hoping to share with audiences.
Yeah, so the families that I talked to have all had online learners for this past school year. And so I am talking with them just about the changes that they've seen and some of the reflections that they've had on the things that they've lost, but also the things that they've gained. I mean, when people have talked about schools and online learning, I was really interested to just hear some of the experiences and offer audiences some insight as to what these families have had going on. And this by no means is representative of everyone's experience. Obviously, the families I talk to have a level of privilege. I mean, they're working from home. They are able to stay home with their kids. So I'm not trying to say, you know, this is what online learning looks like for everybody, because that's just not true. But I did want to offer just a look, especially for people who might not have kids or be familiar with this experience of just such significant change for these families and for their kids.
And how many families were you able to get in touch with to talk to about this?
So I talked with five different families, and they were all a part of this online support group that one of them started on Facebook. And so I connected with the person who created this group, and then she connected me with these other folks. And so it was just those five that I talked to for this.
And was it hard to do a story like this with social distancing?
So I wouldn't say that it was hard or difficult, but it was very different. I mean, usually when I talk to families, I would, you know, meet them in person, you know, interview them in their backyard or their dining room table. But I also thought it was interesting because this is really representative. The way that I talked with them and interviewed them was also representative of their experience this past year. We talked via video chat, you know, and then they sent me pictures and stuff, and we had some more informal conversations over email and things like that. So I don't know that it was more challenging, but definitely different avenues and different from what I would normally want to do or try to do. So outside of the pandemic. So
It's I guess it's a double-edged sword, as they say. It's like, sometimes it's easier because you don't have to travel all over the place. You can talk online, but then at the same time, there's that other element sometimes that you enjoy when you report. I'm speaking for you, obviously, here. But, you know, that element as a reporter where you want to get sort of that personal feel and be in their environment. So it's definitely interesting. Well, could you tell us a little bit about some of the interesting pieces you uncovered while putting this together?
Yeah, so there was definitely a lot that we talked about. I mean, one of the benefits of doing this reporting this way, kind of like what you were just alluding to, is I did all these interviews, you know, in the span of just a few days, but we talked for a really long time. So there was quite a bit that stood out to me. But one story in particular, I talked with a parent. Her name's Jessie. She is originally from Hong Kong, and she's lived here in Bloomington for a little over a decade. And it was really interesting hearing her talk about the way that the pandemic has affected the way she, you know, views family and family time and things of that nature. And so especially with her family, her parents living in China still, that's really far from Indiana. And so she was saying that they don't get a big chance, a lot of opportunity to visit. And so, you know, they're actually making a significant life decision to relocate. And that was affected by the ability to work remotely during the pandemic, combined with that family time that she was getting with, you know, her kids.
And we actually have a clip here of Jessie. Let's take a listen.
our families are mostly in Asia. So for us to go visit them is at least 24 hours of travel time. And we've thought about this for a long time and thought if the vaccines are becoming available and our parents are not getting any younger, and it is really hard for us to visit them or for them to visit us. So we finally made the decision of moving to a coastal city on the West Coast where it will be a lot easier to visit families.
Yeah, and
so
that was
a big step.
Yeah, that was a huge decision and a big change. But the conversation when I was talking with her, I mean, when I asked that question, you know, what have you gained? She talked a lot about the intense family time. And when it comes to, you know, things that they've lost, you know, that time with their people that are very far away, their family. So, and her kids are really young too. So that was a substantial decision that I didn't expect her to say during our interview, but it, I think, was really just a moment to really consider the magnitude of this past year.
Mm-hmm. And so they made a big move, that family. What about other families? Did anything surprise you in terms of the online learning experience? Were some kids thriving in this online environment or struggling?
Yeah, so the thing that I really learned from talking with these families is that it's kind of a mixed bag. There are aspects of, you know, thriving, and there are aspects of struggle, you know, from kid to kid, from family to family. So it was really interesting to me to hear the different things that they've gained and how those differed, and what the parents, you know, were specifically talking about. One mom I talked to, Erica, she was saying that her son, you know, has learned a lot about independence, but time management continues to haunt her. But she was saying that her son really has taken off in subjects that he enjoys, while the other things are a little bit tougher. So she was telling me there's a science project about the environment originally that would have been a diorama thing, you know, that they made. But her son actually made a video game from it instead, because he's really into science and technology and math. So that was just really curious to me. And we also have a clip of her talking a little bit about the effect of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do have a clip here of Erica. Let's take a listen.
So he made it like you're a robot that crash lands on a planet. And when you get out, all the animals answer questions about what, you know, environment you're in. And there's little activities to do. It's super cool. And he wouldn't have gotten to do that at school because they would have had cardboard boxes and they would have been doing craft things, which is cool too. But I do think it's given him the opportunity to do some things he wouldn't have otherwise done.
Yeah, so a very different experience for every kid when it comes to the academics. And that was just a really cool example. And his teacher loved it. So that's always a plus too.
Yeah, so there are some avenues for creativity sometimes when you detach yourself, I guess, from the daily routine. Or maybe it's just forced boredom. I don't know. were there any families that were hesitant at all to share their experiences with you?
Luckily, no. And the reason why, I think, is because just the way that I connected with these families was kind of a voluntary thing. The parent who started this support group, I connected with her. She was very excited to talk to me. And then she kind of reached out to the other families and were like, hey, do you want to talk to this reporter? So they kind of volunteered to speak with me. And also when we were in the interview, I made it very clear, you know, that they could share as little or as much as they want, especially covering stuff during a pandemic, especially covering, mm-hmm. you know, children. I was really pleased with the amount that they shared with me. They were very open, and I was very grateful for that. So luckily, not a lot of hesitancy on that.
Were any of the parents coming to this realization or maybe accepting that they liked online learning and didn't want to go back to the classroom?
Yeah. I know we just heard from Erica, and she actually talked a little bit. I was talking about returning back to school and her hopes, and she was feeling a little bit of re-entry anxiety a little bit. And especially with her son, he was on the call too for a little bit, and he actually said that he never wanted to go back. He loved online learning. And so it'll be interesting to see how that decision plays out. But especially this school year, the conversation, you know, in the spring last year, everybody went home. So they all decided that. And then in the fall, parents had to make this sort of individual decision. And another parent I talked with, her name was Andrea, she decided that, you know, they would start online learning in the fall. But, you know, later in the year, they got into a rhythm. And so she talked about, you know, just keeping it going this school year because they were already doing it. So we actually, I think we might have a clip of her as well.
Yeah, we do. Let's take a listen to that clip.
We were doing okay. We kind of felt in some ways like, yes, our kids have lost a lot this year, but we were kind of thriving. We were able to maintain this. And so we would just keep it up. And we were excited to see vaccinations rolling out. Felt that this again was something that we could do to continue to keep ourselves safe and to better our community by making schools more accessible for others.
Yeah. So when she was talking there, I was asking her about the decision to continue learning and kind of what went into it. And she talked a little bit about that at the end, but you know, she and some of the other parents I talked with, they recognized that they do have the resources to stay home. And with so many unknowns and things like that, they didn't want to, I guess, clog up the system, so to speak, because they did have the resources to stay home, and that kind of informed their decision. And you know, like she was saying, you know, they started doing it in the fall, and they figured might as well keep it going, because going back to school in the middle of the year, you know, that's a significant change still too. With all the tumultuous back and forth and things like that, they just decided to continue doing this. And eventually she would like to return her kids to in-person learning, but for this school year, it was just kind of, we're already doing it, might as well keep it up this way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes people adjust to this new normal and now it's kind of hard to go back. You kind of already got things going. You have your flow. But yeah. As we get ready to wrap up, when can we expect to hear more on the story?
So hopefully I will have one story out next week and then another one the following week. So there will be a teacher piece and then this these families. So hopefully the next couple of weeks, mid-April.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Jeannie Lindsay is the education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about the pandemic a year later. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So before we get to our guests, here are some voices from across the state that shared their stories recently with Indiana Public Broadcasting on how they've been holding up this past year. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Eunice Della Torre, and I'm here to tell my COVID story.
I'm 26, so I'm fairly new in my career. This is only the second job that I've had, but working from home has been a trip. It took me, I'm not kidding, probably about 4 to 5 months to adjust to working from home from working in the office. It took a lot of willpower, a lot of frustration, a lot of feeling like I was inadequate, along with being scared of the virus. I remember before the virus first, you know, really, you know, before the shutdown happened, I went to Costco and everybody was loading up. And I had just happened to go grocery shopping, and I literally put it off for as long as I could, and I made it 2 to 3 months without grocery shopping. And I actually had a breakdown when I decided to go to Costco. I cried because I was terrified that I would catch the virus.
My name is Bill Spalding. Before the pandemic, I sold tickets at the Morris Performing Arts Center in South Bend, Indiana. When the pandemic hit, the remaining productions of the Broadway adaptation of Disney's The Lion King were postponed and later canceled, forcing the box office to close and me out of a job. I finally accepted a temporary position at Teachers Credit Union, but not without a long and hard search for employment. Another change I've dealt with has been not being able to go to a movie, which is why home media and streaming services are godsends.
We are talking today about life a year into the pandemic, looking back at lessons learned and looking ahead. Before the break, we heard how some families were coping. Now we're going to hear from the educator side of things. With us, we have Keith Campbell, president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, and Lori Young, the first vice president of the Evansville Teachers Association, as well as a physics and chemistry teacher at Wrights High School. Let's start with you, Keith. What was it like in the early days of the pandemic when we were first learning about how serious this virus was?
Well, at the immediate, schools just closed so they could better assess what was going to happen and how best to be able to see what was going to happen. But I think if we think back a year ago, I'll speak just for myself. I was thinking 6-8 weeks and we would have a handle on things. It seems odd to think that now, but I distinctly remember some of the decisions we were making as an association and thinking that by summer we would be able to be moving somewhat past where we are. But there were a lot of decisions that had to be made in a very short time to help keep our students and all of our educators safe.
Right, right. And I remember that, too. Everything just seemed like very short-term planning because it seemed like a short-term problem. Lori, did you face similar mindset and dealing with stuff at your high school and also within your teachers' association?
Yeah, we thought, honestly, we would be back in about a week. All here in just a little bit. And then here we are now.
Yeah, a year later, and we're still sort of in this in-between situation. Mm-hmm. Keith, take us through, like, when did you realize that this was going to be a long-term situation and you had to make some serious changes?
Well, I think this has been part of the struggle that we've had in schools and I think for everyone in general, is this thinking, if we can get past the next 6 or 8 weeks, then we're going to be in a different place. And so when we recognized we were going to be out for the rest of the school year, then we were thinking, okay, surely by the summer we'll have things figured out and we'll be ready to enter. And it looked like it was headed that way. If you'll remember, we were talking about flattening the curve. That was the chance that everyone was saying. And up until about July 4th, it was looking like it was going that direction. And then after we finished that summer holiday, numbers started to increase. And that's when we realized as school districts, we're going to have to start making some changes that we weren't anticipating. And that happened in a very short amount of time. And so that's been pretty much the roller coaster that folks have been on through much of this work, especially this school year.
Right, right. And Lori, as a science teacher at the high school level, I mean, how has this impacted your ability to teach chemistry and physics?
Oh, it's dramatically changed it. You're used to doing labs at least once, maybe twice a week. And now it's how do you get into lab when you only have so much equipment and you got to make sure that everybody can get in lab. It's just become a big, huge rotation of activities, and it's hard to monitor everybody. And I think the students are kind of missing out on that time to collaborate with their friends in lab class. So it's dramatically changed the science world.
And have you had to do any sort of, online, like clicking things versus actually handheld situations?
Oh, yes. We've had to do a lot of activities like that. And some of the virtual things are really good and I enjoy doing them, but I think you lose so much of your hands physically on equipment and actually running an experiment. That's the best part about science most times for our students, is that hands-on and clicking away, you lose so much. You lose so much.
Mm-hmm. And Keith, what have you been hearing from educators in the association? Are they feeling like they have the proper tools now? It's a year later. They've learned some lessons, or is it still a struggle to kind of either do hybrid or online or any of those things?
Well, I think the struggle is still there. Some of what has helped has been when President Biden stepped up the way that he did to say that educators have to get vaccinated. And that really pushed some things here for us in Indiana. And we were very thankful for that. So that has relieved a little bit of that about that concern for folks just about themselves. But the work is still just so much more immense than it would normally be. A question that Lori could answer for a student in the last minute of class virtually may take 10 emails back and forth with the student to answer that same question. So life just isn't the same when we're even in that hybrid world, mm-hmm. because the volume of everything that exists to accomplish what we're used to being, you know, we know and understand how to work that class period and how everything's going to go straight through. But anyone that's been on a Zoom meeting knows, you know, how much time is wasted on you're on mute or mute your microphone. And we don't have those type of precious minutes to waste in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see, Lori, you're nodding your head here in agreement with the things that Keith's saying. So, you know, as an educator, have you felt that it's adding more time to your schedule in this online sort of world?
It is to me. I've been in school all year with my students. So I have been teaching, I would say, a decent sized class, 20 to 24 students, which is really low for me. But then I also have to do a hybrid class at the same time. I got to make sure my recordings are always on. And it does take me longer because I can be done with an activity. And then my people who are hybrid learning from home will have questions. And sometimes email doesn't cut it. So I have to set up a Google Meet with them, usually after school is over, because I teach straight through the day. So I don't get time, you know, to immediately answer their questions. And that can cause a problem for some of my students.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Keith, when you hear things like this, has the Teachers Association at all come up with solutions for some of these issues that have popped up?
We have been working a great deal with our local associations and their local school districts to provide schools with the ability. For example, some schools will run a hybrid schedule 4 days a week, but on a fifth day of the week, everyone is remote, which allows teachers some time to be able to get caught up on email, to get recordings done that they may need to do, to learn some of the new gadgets that help. You know, it's great to have the new technology, but there is a learning curve for that. And so we need to be able to give them the time to do that type of work. Additionally, we've been pushing very hard for the need for greater access, especially to broadband, because we've mm-hmm. learned how unequal things have been for our students during this time.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And Lori, what is it like in your day-to-day right now? If you compared to a year ago, or maybe a little more than a year ago, before everything shut down, to now, mm-hmm. how drastic has your life had to adjust?
Well, my day has adjusted. I work even more now, I guess, off the clock. My day starts at 7:15 and goes until 3 o'clock on normal days. I usually still get to work by about 7:15, get ready for my students, but my day doesn't end at 3. I will stay after school until 4:30. I've had Google Meets as late as 10 o'clock at night with some students because they can't get off. They also have a job, so they have to do their job, and then they come in and we have a lesson then. So sometimes my day goes from like 7:15, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And not many, I guess, people have to do that kind of job. I enjoy doing that. I like helping my students out. But it has definitely changed how much time I have to spend online working. And I'm much more, I like being with the people. I think we all do, though.
Yeah, in person is something that I think it's a luxury now.
Yes, it is.
And it's interesting because when we talk about technology, I mean, it's helped in some ways, but it also sheds light on, I think, there's a bigger conversation to be had on the boundaries and how there seem to be none with technology, right? You can text people at all times of the day. You can message them. You can expect to meet. And so where do we draw that line? And so for you, Keith, I would ask you sort of a similar question along those lines, like, you know, how can teachers kind of not spread themselves so thin?
Well, a part of what we've worked on is helping to share information with our members, both learning from one another, but also what other resources are out there that help us to learn how to unplug, to recognize that, you know, when we respond immediately to everything, it perpetuates the thought that if you ask a question into the universe, you're going to get an answer immediately, and that just physically and humanly isn't possible. And so how to work to educate your students and their families about what are realistic expectations about when you ask a question, when you need assistance, when you're going to be able to get a response from folks, that students and educators alike need to have time to unplug, get away from the screen, get outside, get to enjoying family as much as you can in your pod right now. But those are important mental health aspects that have been overlooked, unfortunately, too often during this time.
Mm-hmm. And how does Indiana compare to other states? I mean, have you been looking to how other states have been doing things with education?
The state presidents within NEA, we meet on a regular basis with one another. That's one of the advantages to all of the Zoom that folks are used to doing now, is that you can quickly connect with folks all across the country. But across the U.S., we're facing very much the same sort of issues, and that is that how do you manage a school building that has anywhere from 1,200 to 3,000 or 4,000 students in it when, you know, your scientists and healthcare professionals are saying you need to have this much space among everyone, you need to make sure that the ventilation is proper, you need to make sure that you're cleaning all of the surfaces. Those have been real issues, and in this urgency to get everyone back physically into buildings, we have to take into account what's the human capacity to make some of that happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Lori, I'd like to ask you as we get ready to wrap up here shortly, what are some of the things that maybe you've taken from this past year in the pandemic that will change the way you do things in the future?
Well, when we first started, I was not a fan of having to record all my lessons. I thought, who's going to watch these? Nobody. And here I am. Usually I forget to hit play and record. But I have actually come to grow. I've grown to like it. I have some students who miss the day, and it's really refreshing when they come in. They're like, nope, I already know what we're doing because I actually watched the video last night. So I actually am enjoying that part. I didn't think I would. So I probably am thinking about continuing that for next year. Hopefully I'll get better at remembering to hit record. So I like that. I like that. And yeah. I think I'm also really proud of our students because they handled this and they're doing it really well. Like they'll wear their mask. They don't complain about it. It's wonderful. If I ask, hey, I need some help cleaning this up, there's not a problem doing that. In the past, I always felt like, oh, I've got to clean everything. You know, it shouldn't be the kids' responsibility, but it's really been nice. They all step up. Everyone has stepped up to do their part. So I like that.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's been more of a sense of community now. I think maybe it helps when everybody's sort of bonding over the same situation together at the same time.
Absolutely. I like that. It is. People have bonded. It has become more like a family environment. Going to school, we're all together. We're family here now. We've had the same experiences.
Well, we have about a minute left, Keith. Any last thoughts or advice for folks as we look forward to the year ahead?
I just want to salute all of the educators for the amazing work that they have done this year. No other group of educators have ever faced what we've faced this year, and they have been amazing in creating an environment that has been welcoming of students, that has been encouraging of families, that collectively we're going to make it through.
All right. Well, thank you so much to both of you for joining us this afternoon. That was Keith Gamble, president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, and Laura Young, physics and chemistry teacher at Wrights High School and first vice president of the Evansville Teachers Association. Coming up, we'll hear from a health sciences professor on how we're doing as a state a year after the start of the pandemic. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can download our free app. It's called All in Vox Pop, and you can leave us a message, a voice message on there without having to make a call. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So before we begin with our next guest, here are some more voices from across the state that shared their stories recently with Indiana Public Broadcasting on how they've been holding up this past year. Let's take a listen.
This is Blythe Batram. It's been interesting to me, but also frustrating to see how suddenly things were able to pivot to work from home and have meetings from home, which I was told were not options before as a disabled person. And when everybody needed it, suddenly it became very simple to put these things in place, it seemed. So it's benefited me a lot. I've actually had maybe one of my most productive years ever because I've been able to participate more in a social life and community service in ways that fit better with my abilities, my physical abilities.
George Kelly, it took a while, but I started to realize how little travel I've done in the last year. And that's starting to really get to me now. And the hope, the vision of flying somewhere outside of the state of Indiana in the next few months has become one of the most exciting things.
And again, those were some voices from across the state that shared their stories with Indiana Public Broadcasting on how they've been holding up this past year. Back now to our discussion on where things stand in Indiana a year after the start of the pandemic. With us is Dr. Aaron Reynolds, Associate Professor of Health Sciences at the University of Southern Indiana. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with, this is more of my curiousness, wanting to know if you remember what you were doing when you first learned that Indiana was going to hunker down and hope that this virus was going to quickly pass through.
When you first contacted me about lessons learned over the last year, I started trying to think about those kind of things, about where I was. And I was actually visiting family in Iowa who had already had a few cases of the virus at that point. And so we were at a family funeral and we were, you know, all comparing notes on, you know, there was five cases here and there's, you know, that the cruise has all those cases. And I was in Iowa when Indiana first got their case. And so they announced their very first case at that time. And so it was a little bit like, oh, I have to go back and there's already a case there and what's going to happen. But I remember very clearly a CDC person had gone on the record in February, late February, and said that there were going to be severe disruptions to our way of life. And I remembered going into the classroom the next day and talking with my students about that statement. And, you know, obviously I teach about diseases and outbreaks of diseases and epidemiology. And I was like, what do you guys think? Like, we haven't even had a case here in Indiana yet. Do you think this is going to come to us? And what are we going to do? And it was very interesting at that point, before we had gone on spring break and had an extended spring break and then had the rest of the semester go virtual, to be looking at what might happen. and then compare it to what did happen. And so it definitely did not go along the lines that I thought it would. I used the movie Contagion in class. I have all the students watch the movie. And, you know, there were some similarities and there were definitely some differences. Obviously, there were not as much death. But, you know, I think it spread globally very similarly to how it did in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, I have not gotten to see the full movie yet, but it's kind of surreal to see that sort of predicted something that hadn't happened yet. And I know, I think that was like the number one movie when everything shut down, everybody was watching it. But it's interesting. You mentioned that you'd heard the stuff from the CDC and you talked about it with your students. I mean, how does it feel now looking back a year later? Did you feel that things got worse than what you expected, quicker than you expected, or is this along the lines of what you see typically with outbreaks?
New York was very much along the lines of what was expected. And I think part of the issue in Indiana was that it was very slow moving for our whole state. And so we're doing shutdowns and mask mandates when there's been very few cases or nobody knows anybody who's had it. There wasn't a lot of testing. And so people, I think, felt that it wasn't affecting us. Like that was something in those big metropolitan areas. And why are we having to do shutdowns when we're not New York? And so it was always a fairly slow burn with Indiana. So we were never as big as those bigger states with those bigger populations. And so it does make it very hard to put public health directives in place, especially severe ones like stay-at-home orders, when people feel that it's overreaction.
If you're just joining us, we're looking back and ahead at the pandemic and how it has affected Hoosiers a year later. We'd love to hear your questions and comments. Leave us a voice message through our free app. It's called All In Vox Pop, or you can send us a note via Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Well, Dr. Reynolds, as someone who's deeply involved in this information and data, did you think that a pandemic was inevitable?
Yes. I think a lot of people who study global diseases and how diseases spread, it had just been waiting. I think the 2008-2009 swine flu could have been worse. I think we jumped on that one very quickly, and it didn't end up being as big a deal as I think it could have been. But I think a lot of people think it would have been an influenza strain, kind of like the 1918 flu, that was going to be the next big one. But, you know, these respiratory viruses have been on everybody's radar for many years. You know, COVID is a coronavirus. We've had MERS, we've had SARS. Both of those could have been bigger outbreaks than what they ended up being. And so, yes, this has been on everyone's, who has studied this, it's been expected. That said, it still kind of unfolded differently than how I imagined a pandemic would be.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, when they hear folks that work in this health sciences profession saying like, well, it was kind of expected, we've been watching it, you think like, really, in Indiana, you were concerned about this? You know, it just doesn't come to our minds. How has this virus affected different parts of the state? For example, if you look at urban versus rural areas, has it been the same all around?
No, and that's part of the issue, is that it didn't equally hit all regions. And so, you know, in Evansville and Indianapolis and in larger cities, those hospitals saw higher rates. Those hospitals, you know, saw their ventilator use dramatically increase and their ICU beds dwindle. Whereas I think a lot of people in rural areas didn't necessarily see it. They don't know people who are getting sick, or they know somebody who tested positive, but they were fine. And so those serious cases do tend to cluster more in urban areas where people are having more frequent contact, where your grocery stores are more crowded. I do remember My family did a socially distanced kind of camping trip in southern Illinois kind of during August. And we were asking people, you know, kind of what's the experience been down here? And they're like, we don't have it. There's like, it's not here. We don't know anybody who's had it. They're like, people like you are probably the only people that are getting it. And so, you know, we were still wearing our masks. I mean, this was August. So this was kind of the lull before the next big wave. And, you know, there was a lot of people not wearing masks at that time. We were outside hiking on trails, still wearing our masks, but we felt like we were the only ones. And again, I think that comes from your risk perception. And so whether or not you feel like you're at risk might have to do with whether or not you see people who get sick, or if you know somebody who's had a family loss due to this.
And what is it like for you, you know, working in this field and knowing all of this information and going out and wearing a mask and other people aren't? Does that feel kind of surreal?
It does. And I don't know how it's been a year. And so if you're not wearing a mask and it's been a year, or you're not wearing your mask covering your nose and it's been a year, I don't think behavior is going to change at this point. And so I just have to hope that vaccinations increase fast enough that we don't have to slide back into more severe policies. And so, you know, I look at people who don't wear masks, and I just don't know why. With all of the information that's out there, it's still not enough. And I think it does come down to whether people think they're at risk or not. And if you don't feel like you're at risk, wearing a mask feels unnecessary. And so we need to do always public health needs to communicate clear, simple messages and make sure that we are being consistent in our messaging. And that was one of the issues with the early epidemic, was there wasn't consistent messaging on mask wearing, on social distancing, on whether this was respiratory droplets or whether this was airborne. And so the messy science unfolded in front of everybody's eyes. You know, there were studies that came out that said masks didn't help. And obviously that was a very early study that was done. And it was later shown that masks did in fact help bring down the totals. But I mean, that did damage to the communication. And, you know, the science is not clean and simple. And so having the epidemic unfold in front of everybody's eyes did showcase that we make a hypothesis and then we have data that supports or doesn't support it. So then we redraw our hypothesis and we gather more data to see if we support or don't support that. And then we do another hypothesis. And so it's all of these stages that you have to go through to learn. And the learning just happened out there in front of everybody. And I think that was a little bit damaging to the messaging.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when we first heard about the virus and it was all about don't touch your face. And so it's like you'd go into the store. Now I'm like, how did we go into the store without a mask? We're just walking around like, don't touch your face. Make sure you use hand sanitizer. And it's just it's kind of strange to look back a year how we were to now. It's just the things that we now know. You can't unknow them, you know. But in light of what you're saying about the masks, how do you feel about Governor Holcomb's remarks Tuesday night that, you know, as of next month, this mask mandate's going to be lifted? As a scientist, as a researcher, what are your thoughts when these types of decisions are made?
It feels a little early. I think we're very, very close to getting over this. I was happy to hear that he is opening up the vaccinations to 16 and older on next Wednesday. So next week, it's open to everybody. I would have liked to see the mask mandate carry on until a larger proportion of the population is vaccinated. We're at about, I think, 20%, give or take, depending on how many thousands of people were vaccinated yesterday and this morning and I'm scheduled for tonight, so I'm super excited. But I would have liked to see us, you know, past the 50% mark, or even, you know, I think we're going to need herd immunity rates in the 60 to 70% range. And so I would have liked us to get further towards that vaccination goal before the mask mandates was lifted.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, and
I'm going to wear my mask, but
even while vaccinated, you're going to continue to wear it.
Yes. And so the current guidelines are that you can take your mask off if you're around other unvaccinated individuals or people with low risk. So that will be my goal. I'm hoping to visit some family this summer, and we will all be vaccinated at that point so we can take our masks off. But otherwise, as long as I'm around unvaccinated people, I do plan to still wear my mask.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that moment when you're going to meet up with your family members and not have to mask, that must be, I'm imagining that's going to be a very interesting, like, wait, are we supposed to be doing this or not?
And it feels really early. I mean, so, you know, it's one of those things where I think it's become a little bit of a safety blanket. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think to myself, like, oh, the last time I was on a plane, I breathed air that other people unfiltered air that other people had, you know, been breathing. And I was like, oh my God, I never want to go back to that. You know, so right. I think sometimes we might keep some of those policies in place. Like if you've got a cough or a cold and you go on a plane, you better be wearing a mask.
Yeah. Yeah. It might change some behaviors for sure. When we have these new patterns, I think when I see people preparing food now, I'm like, can you please have a mask on? It just gives a different level. But, you know, as we get ready to wrap up here, what are some of the lessons that you've learned personally or professionally and as you look forward to the next year?
An earlier commenter mentioned about the work from home situation. And I think a lot of us have learned whether or not we are productive working from home or not. But I think we've learned we can be a lot more flexible in our work situations. We can teach classes online if needed, or record lectures if needed for students that can't come. Personally, as an instructor, you know, of college students, I've learned that I need to be more flexible for my students because they have school, they have work, they have family, they have, you know, all of these different stressors in their lives. And it makes it so much easier if I'm willing to be flexible with my students and recognize that they are going through a lot with COVID, and that's going to continue. Life is just always going to be messy and complex, and it is beneficial to be flexible and patient with people.
And real quick, what's one thing you're looking forward to doing once you're fully vaccinated, aside from seeing your family members?
Oh, travel. You know, just to be able to leave Southern Indiana, to go visit friends, to get on a plane. I think another commenter said to just get on a plane and go anywhere.
Right, right. I'm in that same boat. I'd love to travel and just get somewhere sunny. No winter. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Erin Reynolds is an associate professor of health sciences at the University of Southern Indiana. Thank you to all of our guests for joining us today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Steve Versaw was our engineer. If you'd like to listen to this episode again or a past show, you can download it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.